Hey everybody, this is Phil Town.
And this is Danielle Town.
Welcome to the Invested Podcast, where you guys know what we do. We're 5 years into this. You guys pretty much know what we do. So let's keep doing it. Let's just keep diving deeper into Warren Buffett 101 and then all the way to the graduate school.
Ooh. You know,
Warren Buffett investing.
Love that characterization. The Buffett, we don't call it this, but it's the Buffett and Munger podcast, basically.
Yeah,
where we talk about how the heck to learn about long-term value investing.
Yeah. And it's fascinating that it's very hard to get this kind of an education. I will pat ourselves on the back. It's very hard to go to an institution and get this education. In fact, Columbia Business School is famous for being Warren Buffett's alma mater, where Ben Graham taught for years, where Buffett learned from him. And they formed a, you know, sort of Graham school there at Columbia. And remarkably, the professor who shall remain unnamed, who teaches value investing there, just recently retired, that'll be a clue, doesn't really teach this. And it's extraordinary to me how many people say they, and how many people who are good investors worship Warren Buffett and go to his meetings and have been following him for years and don't actually invest the way he does. It's really, really amazing. This kind of investing doesn't lend itself well to institutional investing. It really is difficult for institutional fund managers, meaning Wall Street, to copy this kind of investing strategy, if not
impossible. It's an interesting question. I don't know anything about that professor. There's a great newsletter that Columbia students put out, which is called the Graham and Doddsville newsletter, I think is what it's called. Mm-hmm. Fantastic resource for value investing, profiles of investors, etc. So yeah, I'm not going to co-sign anything negative about Columbia because they're the ones who are talking about value investing in an educational environment, which I think is important.
It is. But I will say, though, there's a certain purity to what Buffett and Munger do.
Yeah.
A kind of religiosity to it. There's a kind of a dogma to it. Not kind of. There's a dogma.
Yeah, there is.
There's a set of beliefs.
And I think that you have strongly educated me about that dogma on this podcast.
I think Columbia is less educated in the dogma than this podcast. And I would be happy to debate that with anybody at Columbia. And I don't think it's very debatable. I mean, you can read the wonderful Graham and Doddsville newsletter, and you'll see for yourself. It is loaded with sort of peripheral kinds of value investing. So there's a broad category.
Well, you know, I also think really strongly that investing is so personal. And I think that's why I'm so drawn to the concept of an investing practice, that you're constantly learning and growing and trying to get better at something that's not perfectible. So I would be really surprised if there were, I mean, I'm sure there are a few, but we all turn it into our own thing, right? Like we all have our own personalities. We all have the types of companies that we're drawn to, just through our own interests and circles of competence. And it makes sense to me that people take the dogma, take the education, and turn it into something slightly different that resonates with them, that works with their lifestyle, with their investing practice. And yes, with their investors, if they're a professional. Those are real life incentives that I think can't be ignored.
I think there's a great bumper sticker from the 70s that read, "Your karma ran over my dogma."
Right.
there's a certain feeling there that dogma is a little bit of a difficult thing in its own right. And I will tell you, I will admit it. You know, I'm about purity in the dogma as I see it. And I'm quite sure that I could sit down with Warren and Charlie and they would go, no, no, this is wrong or that's wrong.
What about your view
about
of
my dogma?
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But there are certain things that, and honestly, it's you see Warren evolving over the years, right? You just see the evolution taking place from the guy who hauled, you know, coffee beans or something for America. I mean, just driving hard goods across town to collect stock certificates, and all the way to now, you know, just being unable by virtual size to do the kinds of things he did in the past. So, yeah, it all evolves. You're right.
And I think about, like, since I've been around, like, I distinctly remember us starting this. And once we got past the initial sort of thing, what is value investing, et cetera, I remember you telling me that Buffett does not invest in tech companies because he doesn't understand them. And even at the time, I was like, wow, that really excludes, like, most companies. And I think, you know, for 10 years ago, tech companies were still rather siloed as tech exclusive. But now virtually every company is involved with tech in a major way. Mm. And true. And so in the last 5 years, we've seen that being true. Buffett famously didn't invest in tech companies, to now he's investing in, like, cutting edge tech companies that a lot of people don't understand, like Snowflake. It's really, really interesting to watch that. And Apple, which people do understand, but, like, is demonstrably a tech company. It's just so interesting to see the way that he's really able to, like, not fall back on his own dogma, right?
Right.
Like, you've got that confirmation bias of he's been saying to the world for 20 years, I don't invest in tech companies because I don't understand them. Not because I don't like them, because I don't understand them. And then he's right. Like, nope, forget that. Got it. Figured it out. I'm on it.
And Charlie,
I think it's amazing.
And Charlie owns a tech company.
Yeah, they've turned true, the Daily Journal.
A bunch of the oldest farts on the planet who are still investing, and literally the oldest group. Charlie makes fun of their board of directors that they brought somebody in who's 84 and he lowered the average age of the board of directors by about a decade. It's just, and it's a tech company now. Daily Journal.
Absolutely. You're so right.
From being a newspaper for lawyers to a technology company that is producing, that is writing software for the courts.
And trying to intricate software. Like,
oh, yeah.
It's not just like they make an app or something.
Oh, one-off software kinds of stuff. Yeah. The toughest kind of software. And Charlie, who, you know, doesn't like risk capital, calls it a venture capital scheme, right? So these guys have certainly laid out the principles of investing, and we've been diving deep into those for years. But those principles are broad, and they really sort of require you to continue to grow as a human being, to continue to open yourself up to new experiences, and to continue to focus on what's turning you on. What do you think about the future? Where do you want to go with the future? And voting for it with your money. So that's all we're trying to teach you to do, is to figure out what you need to know to vote your money. You know, put your money where your mouth is and vote it by putting money into things that you really want to own.
And I think what I really take personally from that is, just because I've said something, I'm trying to think if I've done this. I don't know. Maybe I have already. Just because I've said something publicly doesn't mean that I'm not allowed to change that in the future. And I think there's so many investors who talk about how hard it is to say, like, I really like this company. They say it publicly. They get behind it. They put their name behind it. And at that point, it's really mentally hard to make the shift to change your mind about that company, even when the signs are telling you to. And I mean, Buffett's done that with individual companies as well. But in general, I just find his ability to just change what he's up to so inspiring, because it looks easy. He makes it look easy, but it's hard to do that.
Well, let's talk about that for just a second.
Sure.
It's something that Charlie and Warren pride themselves on, that they stay aggressively within their circle of competence, they believe. But that circle continues to grow. Right?
Totally.
I mean, as you learn, the circle continues to grow and expand. And part of the practice of staying within that circle of competence is to avoid the pitfalls of confirmation bias, that sense that you know, and then you defend it. Mm-hmm. And almost the less you know, like you kind of deep down subconsciously know you don't know, then you defend it even more. Hmm. And confirmation bias means that you look for those things which confirm your opinion, mm-hmm. and you discount those things or ignore them completely that do not confirm your opinion.
And we do it unconsciously. That's the really amazing thing that research has shown.
Really tough part of that.
It's one thing to sit there and be like, oh, I like that point a lot. I must be, propping up my own point, my own conclusion. But mm-hmm. we do it without realizing it. We say to ourselves like, oh, that negative earnings report isn't really a problem because of X, Y, and Z, and I can explain it away. And if you're somebody who's come in without any preconceived notions, you might evaluate it differently.
Well, it's one of the advantages we have if we're working with someone else, right?
Yeah,
that's
true. If you've
got a monger to bounce things off of, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Warren calls Charlie the abominable no man.
Yeah.
Because it's so much easier to say no when it's not your idea. And we do the same thing here. My analysts, I'd throw them ideas and they'll come up with ideas on their own. But if I've tossed them an idea, it's certainly not something I have a stake in, right? I'm not committed to it in any way. Just think, hey, this is a good idea. Take a look at it. Or they come back with something and they say, oh, this is really worth digging into. It's so much easier for me to start chopping it apart, fast. Actually, I like it. It's fun. That's something I like to do. It's just, chop apart that concept that somebody is saying is so great. It's sort of, and it's just a lifetime of habit of doing it. Makes me really fun to discuss things with, doesn't it?
Tell me about it.
Which side do you want to take on this and just go the other way? We wrote about that a bit in Invested. Danielle was about her, me forcing her to think about things she did different kinds of ways, and she did not like it. It was not fun.
Well, we don't have to get into that.
No, we don't have to. Let
going to take a question. I just want to add one more idea about removing your unconscious bias, your confirmation bias when it comes to investing that I've found helpful because I don't have analysts to pay to do it for me. So what I have found actually surprisingly helpful and very irritating is asking a friend or a family member, just whoever, what they think about a given company. If it's a company that they have like heard of or used in some let's say like Amazon, what do you think about Amazon? I'm looking at it this way. What do you think? They don't know anything about how to do investing analysis, but smart people that are smart people. And they can ask questions that usually are questions that me having gone through my standardized process, I haven't thought about. Because there's somebody coming at it totally differently, totally out of the blue, totally off the cuff, right? So it's really helpful to me actually to talk to somebody who knows zero about what I'm trying to do and what I'm researching. Because they're not on the same wavelength as I am. And that really brings up a lot of out of left field types of questions. And then I have to go back and figure out the answers to all those things. And it makes me such a better investor. So that's another free idea and a way to have hopefully a non-annoying conversation with a friend.
And you guys do this stuff. It's just too easy for your brain to get into confirmation bias when you're all on your own and not bouncing ideas off somebody who's willing to be skeptical or who's willing to be challenging about those ideas. So take that to heart. It's a really good, important thing to do. All right. Yeah. What do we got?
Yeah.
What do we got all for questions?
We got a question from Meg. Let's see if my volume is up. Yes.
Hi, Phil and Danielle. This is Meg calling from Whidbey Island. I am wondering if you can help with a question about stock splits and how it affects how we can calculate our margin of safety. I know that we use a historic earnings per share trailing 12 months for the calculation. And I'm a little confused on how when a stock splits like the Apple that split 4-to-1, how we can use historical data to still calculate that margin of safety. Any insights, any clarification you can offer is greatly appreciated. Super love the podcast, love your books, and really enjoyed your class, Phil. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Meg. Meg killing it with the practical questions. I love it.
So can you want to explain what a 4-to-1 split means for Apple? What is that?
Yeah. So what a stock split is when you have X number of stock, every company gets to decide how many shares of stock they have. There's no rules about it. You can have one, although that would make things complicated if you have more than one shareholder. Or you can have a billion shares. Really, the company just 100% decides. So those shares are out there on the public market. And then sometimes for various reasons, usually it's that the price of an individual share of stock is getting too expensive, or they want to shift their ownership around a little. They can just, it's a purely legal method of splitting a share of stock from one into however many they want. So she asked about Apple, where they went from 1-to-4. So a given share of stock that I own, let's say of Apple, is just split into quarters, and I overnight own 4 shares of Apple for that one. And so the total amount of actual shares has quadrupled, but the pie is the same size. The total actual ownership of the company is the same size. Everybody just owns 4 times as many actual shares as they used to. And by doing that, the price of each individual share conceivably would be cut into 4 as well. What tends to happen in the public markets is other things, but that is the legal version of it.
At least immediately it gets cut into quarters.
Yeah, that's right.
The moment, the next day when it opens up after the stock split, it is absolutely perfectly cut into quarters.
Correct.
At the open.
Correct.
And then all kinds of fun things happen. Okay, that's very good. That's exactly what I'd hoped would happen when I sent you to law school.
You sent me to, please.
Okay, when I
can we have more respect for?
Okay, when you chose to go to law school. All right, so it's so interesting because Meg's problem isn't that she doesn't understand the stock split thing.
No, not at all.
Did that
she
for everybody.
Like she got it. Yeah,
she got that totally. It's that in fact that she understands it quite well, and that creates a problem. She's thinking, I'm looking at historical data that goes back 10, 20 years, and that data is, you know, yeah, today I'm looking at it the day before the stock split, and it is historical based on the number of shares. If it's historically, you know, on a per share data basis, then it is absolutely dependent on the number of shares that are outstanding, mm-hmm. Or that are basically out there in the market. And so her question is, after they split it into quarters, how can I rely on data that isn't accurate anymore? It's 4 times too high. Mm-hmm. Effectively. Mm-hmm. And that is exactly a wonderful question, because it does say you understand what's going on. So good on Whidbey Island. Way to go. That's kind of up where I spent a lot of time in my youth.
Oh, is it? I was wondering where it was.
Yeah. It was
around Washington?
It's right outside Seattle, Puget Sound. Cool. It's one of the great places to live, Whidbey Island. It's own little place in the banana
Sounds
belt.
Lovely.
They have sunshine when Seattle's raining.
Extra lovely.
Oh, it is really nice out there. So any case, what happens, Meg, is that this is the great advantage of having data providers, because what they do is the moment that there's an announcement there's going to be a stock split is they prepare to change all of the data to reflect the new number of shares. So they actually go back and recalculate all of the data as deep as it goes, as far back as it goes, in light of the new number of shares. So immediately with quality data providers, immediately when the stock opens and you go to the historical data, you will see that it reflects this 4-to-1 split. Everything will have been cut in by four, divided by four. Now that is everything except the old original documents. They are exactly going to show the shares that existed in that year or in that quarter. So when you go to the original documents, you will see per share stuff going on there that won't be reflected in the compiled data that we use on the internet. And it is one of the great advantages of the internet. Man alive, is that stuff tough to do before the internet came along. Even Value Line would have all kinds of things they'd have to do. They'd have to put notes in the back of all the documents that they're sending to tell you that those documents are no longer accurate, that they've just divided everything by four in your head, right? Stuff like that.
Yeah.
But now it's just automatic and we don't even hardly think about it, Meg. So it's just make sure you're getting data from a good provider, which would mean any of the ones that are big out there are getting fed that information correctly.
Also, I tend to use whole numbers is how I think about it, which is a weird term, I guess. I tend to use like numbers that apply to the entire company and are not per share in my calculations because I do it because I really want to have the mindset of thinking about the entire company always. And as an owner of the entire company, I want to know what's going on with the whole thing. So my numbers I don't actually really, I'm trying to think of like where I use per share and it's very rare. So my numbers really wouldn't change at all just because there's a stock split. So that's like also if you're creating a spreadsheet and you've got, you're tracking it on your own, that's a way to not be subject to these really like artificial changes that are being done.
Now, one more way to go with this is what we do on our toolbox, which is the tool set I built for me to play with and our students use. This just saved me time. And that is I take the current number of shares and I divide it all the way back historically. And in other words, when I want to look at the per share data back in 2006, I want to see it in light of today's shares. Like, how does this company look effectively doing what Danielle's doing, except doing it on a per share basis? I'm looking at the real number, but just divided by the current number of shares.
Wait, I don't understand that. So you take, like, what? Give me an example. What do you mean?
Okay, well, let's say Apple has 1,000 shares, and they split 4-to-1 into 4,000 shares, right?
Okay.
So the historical data on most websites is going to reflect a 4-to-1 split.
Mm-hmm.
True?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Okay. But a 4-to-1 split based on the number of shares that were available in that year back in 2006. So if in 2006, Apple only had 500 shares, a 4-to-1 split's going to make 2,000 shares, right?
Mm-hmm.
And today they've got 4,000 shares. So you'll look back at the data that is divided into earnings per share. It's being divided by those 2,000 shares. And that gives you a, to me, it gives you a misleading view of what's going on in the company. Just as
you're saying, the internet site will automatically use the 2,000 shares, or right. the internet site will automatically use the 4,000 shares.
They're going to divide by, well, they're not going to use any specific number of shares. What they're going to do is divide by four.
Oh, I got you. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
So if there were 2,000 shares, you know, or if there were 500, they're going to multiply by
four. So whatever it was, it's times,
Yeah, it's times four. So whatever it was times four. Now that gives you an earnings per share view of the world in that year, but it doesn't give you an owner's view.
Which I think also what you're saying is, without having said it exactly, is that in this example, between 2006 and now, they created 500 additional shares.
Right.
So they took the company from having 500 shares to having 1,000 shares,
right?
Which is very important to those shareholders of the 500 shares because they just got diluted by 50%.
Exactly. You don't see the historical dilution when you don't plug the new number in all the way back. The historical dilution, so if you're using 2,000 shares back in 2006 after the split, and you're getting a dollar per share of earnings, you're going to be tricked into thinking those earnings were better than they were in today's view of the world. So they, if we look at it through the lens of 4,000 shares, we're going to see that, oh, the earnings are actually 50 cents back in 2006 relative today. And then we can calculate the growth properly, which is what we're really interested in. How have the earnings been growing? Well, if you're faked out by having the wrong number of shares back then, you're going to get a wrong number. And a lot of what happens on these databases is they gift you a wrong number, a wrong growth number. Because, and that's exactly why these guys buy back their stock. That's exactly why they want to talk to you entirely in terms of earnings per share. It's exactly why you don't, or really should be, one of the reasons why you don't use earnings per share is because you're not letting them fool you into thinking the growth is better than it is.
That's that really interesting. I really hadn't gone through that thought process to think about what the dilution would have done to any old per share information. That's really, really interesting.
Yeah, that's why we do it.
So how do you, so you manually take those numbers?
Mm-hmm. We just go back and, well, the computer does it. But yeah, it's just an algorithm that says, ignore the number of shares that were there. So we don't calculate earnings per share from the data set that we get from, let's say, Morningstar or somebody like that, or CompuStat or whoever, S&P 500 or the S&P. We do it ourselves. So, because that's how I want to look at it. I want to look at it the way I taught you to look at it. Look at it like an owner.
Yeah.
But there's advantages to looking at it on a per share basis because you can quickly calculate the price and it's just easier in some ways.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Very interesting. Yeah.
Cool. Well, good stuff, Meg. Thank you for asking that. And hopefully the data that you're using will quickly update itself and you look back historically and there it is. By the way, all the charts do that as well. They immediately change the share price historically to one reflecting the current stock.
Yeah.
So that would be like why Apple was at $460 years ago. You know it was because historically there it is at $460. People talk about it. They wrote about it. Oh, it's $460. I'm going to buy it at $400. Then you go back and you look at it and the chart shows that, oh, when it was $400, it was actually at $13 because they've had two stock splits or something, right? So it can be confusing if you don't know that they're retroactively going back and changing everything to reflect the current shares.
Yeah, it is kind of a messes with your mind a little bit.
Yeah, by the way, some stock charts will change the stock price data also based on distribution of dividends, which can be very confusing.
So, wait, what?
Yeah, they'll.
What are you saying? Did you say they can change the stock price data based on dividends?
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Oh yeah, that gets really nasty. So just a heads up. Look on whatever charting program you're using, and see if they give you a choice to include dividends or not include dividends. I don't mean show you when the dividends occurred or when it was declared, right, to be occurring. I mean they actually adjust price for the fact that people got paid.
What does that mean? So like if a stock price is $10 and the dividend that went out just yesterday is 50 cents. Then this chart would show a price of $10.50.
Some will, yeah. And you'll get this really interesting.
I don't know if I've ever seen that option.
Yeah, just
my charts.
Many don't, some do. Be sure you know what you're looking at, number one. And number two on charting is the other thing is you want to be sure that your charts are set for logarithmic numbers, not linear numbers, because you end up with this really skewed view of the world if you're using a linear chart. A linear chart shows that the distance that the chart moves up, like to your naked eye, let's say it's going up at a 45 degree angle or something for an inch, that amount of distance is the same whether the stock moved from $5 to $10 or from $1,000 to 1,000 and whatever that would be,
yeah,
$5. Yeah. So it's you end up with this very wrong view of how what's really going on. What you want is logarithmic so that a double in the chart moves the chart the same amount. A double in price moves the chart the same amount. So moving from $5 to $10 would be the same as moving from $1,000 to $2,000 in terms of the pricing. Mm-hmm. And then you'll get a view of the world that's more correct.
I also just want to say there can also be reverse stock splits where they take, let's say, two shares of stock and turn them into one share of stock. So just to say that that also exists.
Yeah, and why would they do that?
Well, they want to make their stock price look better.
Right. There's not a lot of good reasons. One of the reasons is that they're having trouble maintaining a stock price sufficiently high to stay listed at the NASDAQ or American or New York Stock Exchanges, which have a minimum. They don't want to have penny, quote, penny stocks, which now today means anything below $5 per share. They don't want them on there. For various reasons, but one of which is there's certain prestige and like there's a certain lack of prestige on having a 42 cent stock.
I think it's also just keeping up with the hundreds of stocks that are at that level. It's like culling the level of workload.
Right, exactly. So, okay, all good things to remember, none of which are really brutally important, except I think what Danielle was saying is be sure you think of it like an owner. Look at it like an owner would. You're not going to look at it per share because there's only one share.
Yeah. Oh, I like that.
There you go.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
All right. Thanks,
Mike. Bye.
Bye. Hi, guys. Thanks for listening to Invested. If you enjoyed this episode and you want more information or to listen to additional episodes, visit our website at investedpodcast.com and sign up for my virtual workshop right there. Spots are definitely limited for this event. I'm not kidding. They really are. They sell out very quickly. So everything discussed on this podcast, by the way, is either my opinion or it's Danielle's opinion. And really important, it's not to be taken as investing advice because I am not your financial advisor, nor have I considered your personal situation as your fiduciary. So remember that. You're on your own here. This podcast is for your entertainment and education only, and I really hope you enjoyed it.